Earlier in 2021, I spoke with Emmy-winning actress Erin Cherry, who won that award for her supporting role in an Amazon Prime series called After Forever. Well, today I'm speaking with the co-creator and producer of that series, Kevin Spiritus, who has also produced on Broadway as well. But where he really made a name for himself is as an actor both on stage and screen, particularly as Dr. Craig Wesley in the long-running soap Days of Our Lives. But even for someone as persistent and confident as Kevin, there are times when motivation is hard to come by and isolation can become all too easy.
I found myself in 2014 really isolating and staying inside more than anything. I didn't want to go down into the subway. I didn't want to take the extra effort to walk 10 blocks to get to something that wasn't sourcing me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, or Win Me for short, one of Feedspot's top 25 theater podcasts. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer for almost 30 years. Now, each week you'll learn from fellow actors and creatives as we explore the challenges of trying to make it in this business. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com. There you can support and donate to this podcast, as well as get info on valuable artist resources. Learn about all that and more at whyillnevermakeit.com or click on the link in the show notes. I first met Kevin Spiritus when I was doing a cruise contract on Royal Caribbean. And as a production singer, our cast did three shows throughout each cruise. And between these shows, headliners like Kevin would come in and do their one-hour sets on the main stage. His show was a one-man tour de force chronicling his rise to stardom as a theater and television actor. But Kevin is also known for his film work, especially when it comes to horror film sequels. Now, after getting off the cruise ship, Kevin and I continued to run into each other at auditions, often for the same role. And between the two of us, I'm sure there's no surprise who was often cast in the role. I mean, Kevin has 5 Broadway shows on his resume. However, only 2 of them are as an actor. The other 3 are as part of the production teams. And it is this transition from stage actor to producer that we will be talking about in this episode, in addition to his work in film and television, particularly his series After Forever, which has won many awards, yet also faced tragedy with the death of co-creator and writer Michael Slade. But first, we start off with a discussion about the balance of luck versus intention when it comes to the direction of our careers. Welcome, Kevin. It is so great to have you here on the podcast and to actually see you again.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much. It's great to be seen.
Yes, as actors, we do love to be seen. So that is true. Now, I wanted to start off today talking about intention, you know, the way that both luck and purpose kind of direct our careers. And you got your professional start in the Broadway National Tour of Chorus Line, but you've also found success in television, particularly soap operas, as well as major motion pictures like the horror film sequels. And so how much of that variety has come from a conscious decision to transition from one medium to another, and how much of it is just kind of luck, you know, being at the right place at the right time?
I'm going to say there's 2 parts to this question. So let's do the first part about intention. I'm someone who for my entire life has been a firm believer in creative visualization. If you think it, if you see it, if you feel it, you can become it. It sounds hokey sometimes, but it really is. Every word and action and behavior and song, everything that comes out of our mouth and out of our being in that moment creates the very next moment of our life. So we are constantly moving forward and creating. I like to say it as the 2 most holy words in the human language are, I am. That's the Moses and burning bush. And he said, who are you? And God said, I am that I am. So I am, and anything that follows that is so powerful. So when we say we are excited about going to school or class or this job, you are excited. You kind of jumpstart yourself into excitement. And if someone is saying, oh my God, it's just this test is so hard, or this program is so hard, I just can't get it. What is coming out after I can't do something? So that's about intention. I think you need to set an intention, and you have to find the thing that aligns with your joy, with your talent, with your heart. And for us, it's creativity. I think we do make our own luck. And I think we do it by seeing something and going, I like that. I want to do that. I want to do something like that.
I think almost every actor has had that, you know, especially seeing it on stage and wanting to be that.
And I didn't, you know, I grew up in an age where we had 3 television stations and maybe 2 syndicate channels, and there wasn't a lot of content. And we had all of this time to fantasize and to visualize. And I used to watch the Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire movies. I was a movie musical, you know, fanatic, and I'd sneak up in the Late Late Show and I want to do that. I want to be like that. I want to dance like that. And then Chorus Line came to town. I was 17, I think 16 and 17. They came 2 years in a row. And I auditioned at 17 and they said, one more year. I went, oh. But I remember seeing Mike Costa singing, I Can Do That. And that was my song. That was my theme. That's what I believed I can do. You give me some, I can do that. I can do that. Jamie Torsellini started in Song and Dance, and he came out here, became a good actor and does a lot of work. And I remember meeting him on the streets in New York at 18 years old in 1981. And I said, hey, you were in the tour that came through St. Louis in the Chorus Line. You played Mike. He said, yeah. We became friends. And one day we're walking by the Schubert Theater, and I went, God, I want so badly to be in that show. Now, I knew that show. I saw what that show was. I could see myself in it. And he said, well, why don't you take your picture and resume to the stage door? They're having a closed call next week. I'm sure they'll call you in. So I didn't waste a minute. I went home, got a picture and resume, knocked at the stage door. I said, I'm Kevin Spiritus. I'm not Equity, but if you think I'm right for something in the show, please call me. And they did. And then I prepared the dance because I was kind of nervous about freezing or having 2 left feet. And Jamie so graciously taught me the opening combination and the ballet. And I was plucked out of that lineup with Jerry Kolker. Jerry Kolker stayed in New York to play Al, and I went out to the Bus and Truck National. It was an outstanding experience because it's what I envisioned since the time I was in high school. What's that, 10,000 hours? You know, maybe I wasn't putting in 10,000 hours, but I knew the thing I wanted to do. And later on in life, what started to also happen, this is the other part of that question, is people would say, what do you want to do next? And I go, I like that. I kind of, if I didn't get specific, it kind of was nebulous. It was like, I just would kind of be like in and out of the ethers of creativity. And then I'd see something, I want to do something like that. And I can tell you 4 examples of that. Quantum Leap, the pilot that came out on television. I was with a friend. We were having dinner. I said, that's a fucking great show. And Scott Bakula is from St. Louis. I want to be in that show, a show like that. And the next day, boom, audition. Hmm. There was something for a horror film. And I got the horror film. Boy from Oz. I didn't know the show. I hadn't seen the show. And this is many years later, after I was on the soap, my agent said, they want to see you again. I said, what, did Jared Emick drop out? Because I know that's the only role I can play. No, my agent said, this is to be Hugh Jackman's standby. And I immediately knew this was my job because I love Peter Allen. I know that I was ready to go back to Broadway. And I know that I wanted to go and deliver the gift that I know I could bring to Peter Allen. Because he was just all through my life. And they even said to me, thanks, Kevin, that was great, after I sang my song. And I went, thanks, Kevin, that was great. I flew out 3,000 miles to hear, great, Kevin, thank you. What are you saying no to?
Who says that?
And the casting director, David Clemens, went, I said, you're saying no that I'm not 6 foot. I'm not 6 foot. I'm 5'10 and a half. You put me in humps. I'm a grower, not a shower. I'll be here till Tuesday. And if you would like to bring me back, I would be grateful and happy. And I walked out of that audition and I was pissed.
I mean, so that took some cojones to stand up and kind of speak your mind like that.
Yes, but it took confidence because I killed the song. I killed the room. It was only four of them at the time. And I just knew this was my next stop. Like when I got the call from my agent, I turned to my partner at the time. I said, I'm going to be moving to New York. So anyway, I was furious. I went to my friends and she's there and she's consoling me. And the cell phone rings about an hour later and it's the assistant saying, can you be back here tomorrow at 10 a.m.? And I was like, yes. And then it started all over again. I got to the audition. They were asking me. I mean, they had me jumping through hoops. I was early in the morning. And when I got called back that moment, there was four of us and they positioned me last. But I just sort of sat in my chair and I watched these other three gentlemen. They weren't out of their body, but they just were like, the conversation one has when they are in intention or when they are in a group of people, you have to be very, very careful about what you're speaking about. And I just watched these three people. Oh, when is it starting? Next week? Because I'm going to go somewhere tonight, but you can call me. Like, it's all like, me. But I would hear them crash and burn in the room before, and I was fourth, and they dropped me in, and I sang my song, and they asked me how tall I am. I said, I'm a grower, not a shower. Let's do this. And then they had me sit outside for 10 minutes. That's a long time by yourself, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And everybody left the room. And the director came out and said, Kevin, how tall are you? And I said, I'm probably 5'10", in maybe a half. You give me lifts. He goes, I said, if I don't get this because of an inch, I'm going to scream. You're going to hear bloody murder. He says, just calm down. Because, they wanted me to be able to move into Hughes costumes because they can't build in them. Anyway, they came out, they got me, they brought me in, and they go, Kevin, you know what this is for, don't you? And I said, yeah, to stand by for Hugh Jackman. And they said, yeah, and three other covers. So when can you start? I said, those are the faces you're saying, when can you start with? I mean, come on. I mean, it was like, so I just was like, I had freedom. And I think freedom is a very important thing to move into intention with. I also want to say the thing about conversation. This is a really interesting topic you brought up in one question. You have to know your conversation. You have to know the group of people you are talking to. For example, on a soap opera set, there are contract players, there are recurring roles, there are date players, there are extras, there's directors, there's crew. All of the contract players hang and talk in the contract player conversation. Like they speak about things that contract players talk about. And the under fives are over here talking about, I hope I can get it. Maybe someday the casting director will, that's the same little conversation. And what I learned very early on was you have to be able to leapfrog from conversation to conversation and know how to adapt your conversation. Because if you are a singer and I'm an actor and we're on the stage and we really don't have that thing in common, I want to go, hey, Patrick, what's going on with you? Tell me about the song that, I want to know. So you're including everybody and you're able to speak to everybody. And it's a very important tool is to speak the same conversation.
Yeah, I do think that is that's so important that you bring that up, because that conversation, which comes down to relationship, how you relate to certain people, whether they're in front of the camera, behind the camera, on stage, backstage, how you relate to these people, it says not only something about you, but it says something about what you want to bring and the kind of family almost that you're wanting to create around a particular show.
Yeah. But you also think about it next time you're around on a set or even on the street, you're watching the homeless talk to the homeless. You're watching the elite talk to the elite. You're watching the grocers talk to the grocer. It's the same stuff. People stick to their same comfort story, and we've got to know how to step outside of that, especially when it comes to intention, because the intention that you have sometimes is somewhere over in that other conversation.
Yeah.
And you might need to learn how to speak that.
Yeah. And doing that leapfrog to that next level or next conversation is so important, because I've heard you say that your first love was theater, and that live energy connection with that audience. Yet it seems like most of your work and fame has come from television and film. Why do you think that is?
Because I have a secret feeling. I think I lied. I love live theater. I love live theater, and the shows that I've done were absolutely fulfilling to me in every capacity at that time. But I think I didn't outgrow it. But after Boy from Oz, when I saw how much work it really takes to be a star in a show, a great role came along. I would not deny it. I would accept it. But it is such work. You've got to be an athlete. And I think as I've started to age and move into an older maturity about my life and about my career and my work, it's kind of easier to step onto a set, put it in your head, and then let it go.
But that kind of ease didn't happen overnight. So when was it that you started to learn that?
I was in New York, and I was not getting the auditions that I wanted. And I was getting sent in on things that I really wasn't right for. And I'm talking about an agent not really being clear-minded when he said, look, it's a gay role. You're gay. Go do it. I'm like,
Yeah. I've had my agent send me stuff like that. It's like, yes, this is in the LGBT world, but that doesn't mean that's all I can do.
Yeah. And it's, if you're going to send me out for a gay role, send me out for the Will of Will and Grace, not the Jack of Will and Grace. It's not going to stick to me. So anyway, I got a lot of auditions that I would say, I'm going to pass on that. And my agents were like, okay, I you don't want to do it. I said, of course I want to do it, but I want to go in on the right role. That's an intention. And what it ended up creating was, I knew I had something personal to say. I knew I had something personal to reveal. And, for the longest time, I did not ever talk about my sexuality. I never led with my sexuality. People who knew me or may have known about my life knew that I am gay, and that's just that's what it is. It was never an issue when I stopped making it an issue. Because by the time I was 50, Will and Grace, there's every, LGBT, this and that, and everything was starting to populate. And I thought, what do I know? I'm a single man, I'm 50, and I'm looking for love. Like, that's personal. So a dating show is what I kind of thought. And on June 1st, 2014, I ran into Michael Slade, is now the late Michael Slade. He was a writer on Days of Our Lives. And he said to me, I think you're Kevin Spiritus because I used to write for you. And I went, oh my God, what's your name? Michael Slade. I remember it on the scripts. I said, what are you doing now? He said, I'm dabbling in something. I said, we need to write a new show, a new show about gay men over 30 who know themselves. And he goes, call me. That's another form of intention. That's another, I wanted to create something that would express my truth. And I didn't know what it looked like. My little idea of doing a dating show, and every week would be a new date, I had to have room for it to be something else. And Michael one day said to me, I said, first of all, I said to him, all I want to do is I want to get up in the morning. I want to put on my clothes. I want to go to the set and continue being me. I don't want to have to twist a mustache. I don't want to have to put on disguising makeup. I just want to be me. And I want it to be the lead that I know I am. And back to Days of Our Lives, when I first went on to Days of Our Lives, I did a two-day role. And I remember that it was a very highly featured day player. And the storyline was over there, and they were trying to get a guy and a girl to do their thing and push them together. And it was against their will. And I just looked around and I said, no one's going to come to me and talk to me about how I'm doing, because I'm like the day player. And I know the conversation that goes around on the set. And I said, I'm just going to pretend I'm on a movie set. I had my little movie for 2 days on Days of Our Lives. And the next day, Fran Vascom, our casting director at the time, got a call from Tom Langan saying, where did you find this kid? He's fantastic. So she said, go back and do the same thing. And I did. And then 7 months later, they had written my role in. So these are things that you just, you do the work, you do the intention, you stay positive, you have your priorities, you have your patience, your perseverance, your principles, you have your peace of mind, no panic, and you have process over product. And those are the things that you have to lock into. So Michael and I wrote a show. We wrote After Forever. We came up with the idea, and it was by 2015, I told him we were almost finished writing all 8 episodes. And I said, good news and bad news. Bad news, I'm getting out of New York. I can't stand it. Good news is we're going to finish these scripts, and we're going to do a reading. And we're going to go to Pearl Studios, and I'm going to invite every investor I know, and they're going to come see it, and they're going to cry, and they're going to say, here's your money. And that's what happened.
What was it that was the last straw for you in New York? What made you want to leave?
I grew up in the suburbs in St. Louis, and I thought New York was always going to be my escape, my dream, Broadway. But it started to feel very small to me. You were on the same track all the time. I felt very claustrophobic. I feel that everywhere you go, your senses are constantly assaulted. You are never escaping noise. I even tried to make it the music of the city. Oh, yeah, bum, bum, bum. Shut up, fuck up. I mean, I couldn't do it. And I found myself in 2014. I was there 7.5 years. In those last 2.5 years, I found myself really isolating and staying inside more than anything. I didn't want to go down into the subway. I didn't want to take the extra effort to walk 10 blocks to get to something that wasn't sourcing me. So I knew I would eventually come back here, and I did. And the sunshine and the mountains and the ocean make me just... So I'll go back to New York to work. I don't mean I won't ever go there.
But not to live.
I don't want to live. I did it. I'm 59 years old. And, you know, that's a young person's city.
I find that I'm in that same position of the city hasn't so much lost its luster. There's still a magic and an energy here. But at the same time, as you say, as far as living day in, day out, it can be a city that just, it kind of starts to isolate you because you don't want to go all the way over there, do that and this.
I'm telling you, the reason God created a hatchback is so you didn't have to carry your groceries home on your back.
Right? Right. Well, now we have grocery delivery, so at least I don't have to do that. But then, that can cost.
And the expenses in New York just became outrageous. And I thought, you know what? I get more bang for my buck. And I do like my own space. I do like my own car. I know it's not necessarily economically world saving, but I do get a lot of work done in my car.
Though Kevin may have chosen Los Angeles over New York, the Big Apple still holds a special place in his heart, both personally and professionally, especially when it comes to his work as a producer. To hear more about his transition to producing, there's a special excerpt from this interview on the Why I'll Never Make It YouTube channel, as well as a bonus episode of him answering the final 5 questions. You can look for links to both of those in the show notes. Well, getting back to theater and all that, as far as acting for the stage and television and film, they all require slightly different adjustments from an actor. How would you describe these differences between these three and how you as an actor have made these adjustments?
You know, I started on stage and theater and everything was be big, be, you know, over, you know, and I did that. And then, of course, I get to L.A. with the tour of Chorus Line and... I had many, many auditions, and they would say, thanks, Kevin. He's just a little big, you know, or a little light in his loafers. I wasn't at all comfortable with my sexuality, and I wasn't at all comfortable with being thrown into a world that was so hetero oriented. And it, you know, it frightened me because you always, for me, growing up, knowing that I have this secret at the time and knowing that I was gay, but didn't necessarily know that's what it meant. I would see how people in the world would react to people who were gay, and they would be, they wouldn't be loved unconditionally. Mm-hmm. Now, my parents love me unconditionally, but when I would hear them, I'm sorry, Mom, Dad, I'm telling the truth. I would hear them talk negatively about some gay person or something, and I would hear their tone, and I would say, if that's the tone that they're just conversing about, not being racist or anything, but just like they have a maybe a prejudice, or they're like, oh, you pays me, you know, that's their son. I can't be that, or I'll be killed, or I will not survive because they won't accept that. So that was my own projection. And it was for a while true until I made it not true, until I found myself able to stand in my strength and my spirit and my spiritual practice. I don't know where they came from. I don't know where you came from, but I came from something so greatly out of understanding to me that I'm going to let him worry about that or her worry about that. And that's really kind of where I moved from. And that's why I was able to do After Forever. I was able to jump in that. The television, I remember a cold reading class. And later that day, I had an audition for The Hills Have Eyes Part 2, directed by Wes Craven. And it was to be the first of my slasher film sequels. Mm-hmm. And this teacher said, during our cold reading class, not even in the scenes that I was reading for the movie, but just, you know, pretend you're over the mountain. What's going on, Patrick? You know, and gave us all these exercises. And I get to this audition about 4 or 5 hours later, and my character had to yell over a mountain. And I just remember, okay, what did you learn today? So I started to actually do what I was learning. And it wasn't big, it was real. And I was also learning about looking someone in the eye and just really being able to talk to them and slow down. And then it came down to other things. I did a play here in LA called End of the World Party. It was written by an incredible writer named Chuck Ramberg, who won several Emmys for Frasier and Cheers as a writer. But it was a great ensemble piece of Gay Man on Fire Island. And it just fit me. Like, I remember reading that audition, going in there, just saying, I can do anything because it's me. And I got it on the spot. It was so wild. You know what your truth is. You know what it is. You know when you're going to get the call. I could have been on the moon and I would have run into Michael Slade.
Right. When it's meant to be, it's meant to be.
That's the universal crossing point. We were meant to meet. And so anyway, I had to learn how to trust that my acting was being received, even if it was just talking like this or intimate, and learn how to buck it up. And then I got a soap opera, and that was like great hands-on training for a year. Right.
Yeah, because earlier this year, I was watching a video by Laurie Wyman. She put out a short video on how to be a better soap opera actor. And one of the things that she mentioned was this over-the-top nature of soap opera acting. Would you say that's a fair characterization of it?
I don't want to get in trouble, but I think soap opera has become a very, very challenging medium. I think in the very beginning, it was something that this is how the people spoke. They were very eloquent. And now there's a commercial from Tide. It was the style. And as the years and decades have gone on, these soaps, the ones that remain, they tell some really great story and they tell some very provocative things as well. And then they tell a lot of schlock. And I think it's not even always in. You're not even dropped in. So is it over the top? Do people have to say subconsciously, watch me cry? You know, it gave me a life. Days of Our Lives gave me a life that I had no knowledge would ever happen to me. And Patrika Darbo and I became the number one non-conventional daytime couple because of our, you know, I was kind of considered this hunk and she was kind of considered this woman of size. And they kept saying, you fell in love in high school and that's it. Okay. So if that's the rule, that's the rule. We became great and popular. If they take us back, maybe they'll give us some really great fun stuff. I don't know.
So, I mean, what has it been like to have been known and identified with that singular role? Your part is Dr. Greg Wesley on Days of Our Lives.
Well, some people is crazy and they think that I am really a doctor. Though I just played one on TV. I love the acknowledgement that people are seeing me stand in a successful place with that as the entree. You know, like I was at the bottom of the barrel again and Fran Bascom said, come in, I've got this 2-day role for you. I want you to talk to me about it. I don't know what my career would have been like. I just know that it was time for me to make a new shift, a change, an intention. And it happened. It happened. And this is at a time when I was still receiving breakdowns. Because, you know, we're not supposed to get the breakdowns. That means you're too, that's another way of controlling you in this business.
Right.
But I was still getting the breakdowns and I would get my own auditions. I would figure out a way to call in and get my audition, or I knew the person and I was working my butt off and I was working, but I was doing all the work. The tools of what I do as a go-getter with the intention of making sure I know what's going on or see who's doing what is... get that person. Okay, I'm going to put those two people together. It's just, that's the producer in me.
Right, so. Right. The one who sees the puzzle pieces and knows how to put them together. Yeah,
Makes it up putting it together.
Right. Or can make it up. I mean, that's a useful skill. That's something we do as actors and putting these characters together in relationships as well as on the other side, whether it's producing or directing. And so did it feel like, whether it was during this time of being on a soap opera for so many years or maybe at other points in your career, did it feel like you had arrived? Did you feel like you had made it in this business?
By the time I got to do Days of Our Lives on national television for just under 8 years and the personal appearances that I was asked to do and the fundraisers I was asked to do and the cruise ship shows I was creating. I mean, star of television's Days of Our Lives. That there is something about that elevates at least the ear. Yeah, you're hearing something, but it's I don't think I ever abused it, and I never like went, hey, I'm on the soap, you know. But it is nice when people would acknowledge your work, or they acknowledge they saw you, or they liked you, or they know me by my character name and not my real name. And there were times even during the soap that I was like, oh God, this story, why are we doing this? It's okay. Hi, I have one line. Okay, see you later. Can I go now? You know, it was not ever lost on anybody that we have these ebbs and flows of great story, of great, powerful, moving content. And then it's like, and they're still paying you. And that gets to be very much a trap.
Mm-hmm.
I was written off the show. New head writers came in. I was written off the show. And I went to audition for a lot of Broadway shows. And then I came back home and ended up getting Hairspray in Vegas. And I love Mark Shaiman. I love Scott Whitman. I love Jerry Mitchell. I love Jack O'Brien. I knew three out of the four. And then since I've done the show, Jack has become very dear to me. But I really wanted Boy from Oz, and I didn't get Boy from Oz on the first round with when I auditioned for the boyfriend. And then I went here, and I didn't get Corny. for the national tour. I said, I just got off the show, Days. This is perfect. You can promote Days of Our Lives, Star Kevin Spears, Courtney Collin. I mean, it just didn't fall into that place. And then, of course, I went and I did Boy from Oz. And then after I came back home, I did Hairspray. And Mark Shaiman and I were having pancakes all you can eat at one of the cafeterias. And he said, so it all worked out. You got to do both shows.
Yeah.
Very sweet. But, you know, your mind doesn't think that way. Your mind thinks, oh, God, you know, I'm broke. Or,
Yeah, it's very easy to get stuck in the present and like, where am I now or where am I not? And just be focused on that. Yeah.
And when I was visiting LA from New York, I was still living there for those 7.5 years. I had a couple of concerts that I had back here at the Carpenter Center and Sun Valley. I was sitting in the bedroom of my good friend, second bedroom of my good friend Barbara Deutsch's house, and she's in her office and she says, get in here. I said, okay, watch this. I just gave your name to a client of mine, and she's a career coach and a really good personal coach. And she said, he wrote a play and he's looking for a producer in New York and he needs to do a lot of work, but I gave him your name. What? Oh, yeah. You produce your career better than anyone I know. You can do this. So I meet with Don and I read the script, and it's a good solid script. And then I learn that Meryl Streep will be playing in the reading, and Grace Gummer will be playing in the reading, and Henry, her son, will be playing in the reading. And I went, if I can't sell a ticket for this, then I'm going to go home.
Right.
And I got a list of the Broadway League, and I sent out emails, and we did the invite, and it was a huge success. And she didn't take the job eventually, but I stepped out on stage and I said, "Hi, my name is Kevin Spiritus. Please turn off your cell phones and enjoy the show." And the next day, my life changed because everybody was calling and everybody wanted to know. And you probably know half the producers, the Jamie DeRoy's, the Alan Marks and Barbara Marks and Scott Morrow's. And I mean, I just was like. After the reading, Alan calls me up and says, I want to have lunch with you. And I said, okay. I like the way you work. I like the way you stand in your life and your style and your personalization of what you're doing and what you're saying. I'd like you to come work with me on a new musical called Finian's Rainbow, The Revival. And I went, what does that mean? And he says, I need to go raise some money. I go, ah. Oh, right. Okay. Sure. And I said, how am I supposed to raise money? He says, I'm sure you have wealthy people in this industry who want to be part of the musical world and they are intrigued by Broadway. You should take a look. And, you know, it's not the show you're selling. It's your vision of the show. Right. Very important. It's right. Your intention. And that has helped me. And I think I raised $650,000, and that was beginner's luck.
I mean, I certainly know in my own career, which has not achieved the heights that yours has, but I've had my own moments of getting too big for my britches, as they say. You know, with all the accolades and fans that you've had over the years, has humility or staying grounded ever been a struggle for you?
I'm going to honestly say it probably was in the very beginning. I was probably a little brat, kind of, you know, shitty to a lot of people and arrogant and I deserve and all that stuff. But I will say this, as I did Days of Our Lives, as I watched other people on that set act horrifically. Not just on the set, but outside the set. I will not name names. But it showed me that is not the life I want to be associated with. And again, you know, you either talk to certain people in the camp or you avoid certain people in the camp. Mm-hmm. So you know who you're avoiding and then they cross promote anyway. But So that was one thing. And then I have to tell you, I think the gift that I got from being cast as Jackman Standby in The Boy from Oz was I watched him every single day for probably the first 4 months. I was told that during previews, he was most likely going to drop out. Patrick Vacariella, the musical director, said, all my big stars drop out. They do a couple shows. They get a little nervous. You're going on. I went, huh? So I put this script in my brain in 2 days, thanks to the soap opera muscle. I knew the songs, and I figured I'd wing it if I had to. He never missed a show. But I would watch him. I would watch him step onto the stage and open himself and just, and it wasn't just to the audience. It was to people on stage. It was the people in the band and in the orchestra. It was to the ushers. It was to the people in the bars at the back of the, I mean, he, and the fans going outside, it was just, nothing was ever wrong. And I recently wrote him a letter and I thanked him. And I said, you know, he's a big fan of After Forever. And we talked about that. And then we had this reunion on Zoom and he sort of mentioned something. And then I said, I got to say, it started at the top. We had Hugh Jackman. And I don't remember a time when I just was like, well, what would Hugh Jackman do if he were in this situation? Like that's the guy. And I told him that. I said, because this last year, I was brought to my knees more times than I can care to count. It was a terrible year of loss. We had politics and I just said, you know, I'm so grateful that I got to watch what you did and make it always right. He never argued for a limitation. He would rally for some sort of abundance at all times. And I just loved that. And I said, I will never, ever leave this place not knowing. I mean, I kind of feel that was the best thing for me to do because I see people. I learned their names on the ship. I don't know if you know this, but when I would be on the ships, I'd say, hi, Patrick. Oh, nice to meet you, Patrick. Is this your wife or your partner? You know, and I play a game. Mm-hmm. I introduced myself and then I would see them maybe the next day. Patrick, how you doing with that lovely lady? And that's, you remember my name. And I made a game of it. But you know, there's a lot of people on those ships. And I really made it my mission because I think it does something for me. It passes the time, but I think it makes people feel good. And I think they're going to come see my show. You remember my name.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. 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 It's so interesting. I mean, that gets back to what we were saying about relationships, whether it's the people you work with or those that come to see us. You know, It's important to make those connections and make them feel a part of the process because the audience really is that other part of the show where they're giving just as much as we're giving on stage.
Right.
And our performance can so be either matched or be affected by what the audience gives us. So they are essential to that whole process. Yeah. So it's important that we respect that.
And Jackman would stop the show. Like it was, oh, wait, stop. This isn't, wait, is that man okay? Heart attack? Hold on. And he would handle it. And then he would bring you right back. Okay, let's celebrate. Come on. And he also had that ability because did you ever see the show?
I never got to see it. Yeah.
Broke the fourth. Here, I'll do it all for you right now. he broke the fourth wall as Peter Allen.
Right.
You know, so he never really knew if it was quite Peter talking as Hugh or Hugh talking as Peter, but it just became quite lovely. You know, great.
It's wonderful to embody those kind of characters that have such freedom and liberty to express themselves. I think as an actor, it's those kind of shows that have really propelled me and not only made me kind of fall in love with acting and theater all over again, but it's also grounded me whenever I do have specific lines, when I do have a kind of a boxed in character that I need to live in. That kind of freedom helps all avenues of my acting.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Also, there's nothing like live theater. There's just nothing like it. Nothing. But there is also something remarkable about doing a scene over here, very intimate, out of order of what your story is about, and then going over here, and then a year later, it's all edited together, and you're going, it takes you on such a ride. Mm. Oh my God. You know, it's really quite remarkable. And I find it easier to act on the camera, for the camera, or the taping situation versus live theater, because there's so much depending on the live theater, because you might have 10 cast members, but the 11th cast member is the audience.
Right.
And you can just never count on any of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You never know what that particular night, what audience is going to bring. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's certainly one thing to be cast in say a regional production or maybe a one hit TV show, but it's quite another like you to be consistently working year after year. And as you look back on your decades in this business, what do you think is that secret to its longevity?
I never give up. Until recently, and I say this within the last few months because I just hit a wall. I'm probably one of the hardest working men in show business. And it's not because I'm constantly working. It's just I'm figuring out the next step. I'm figuring out the next move. I'm figuring out, right. So even if After Forever can't get done and we do a spinoff on that for one season, then we do the third season, that third season is going to end. What else is out there? And if I'm going to sit here like an actor, and this is another thing about where you lead from, actors have very little control and very little say in anything. It's not, it didn't mean to happen that way. It just is what it is.
Yeah.
And, but if I lead from producer in my life, if I wear that hat and lead and go through life and the streets going, oh yeah, and then get an acting role, if I then lead from that as a producer into that acting role, that's when I'm a fucking great actor. But if I lead from actor all the time, it's wishy-washy and it's my agent's not getting that.
It's that mind shift. Of an actor grasping, wanting, reaching, as opposed to the businessman, producer, the artist who's creating and is a part of his career rather than just a rider along, you know, along for the ride.
Well, and Michael and I, Michael Slade, I said, you know, let's write a story that we can tell, that we can be responsible for, right, and it be personal for. And we knew we had something and we could do something and I could raise money for it. And someone said, why don't you just film the first episode and sell it to a network? And I went, and let them take it away from us? Are you fine? We got to be in the kitchen anyway. Let's just do all the kitchen scenes. We got to be in the, you know, and that was a powerful piece of gripping our career. You know, that's what we took back as our careers, because we've been in it too long to know.
Right. I mean, you are certainly still going strong today, you know, so your longevity continues. And the latest example of it is your Emmy winning series After Forever. Now, this LGBT themed series on Amazon Prime has won awards for writing, directing, acting, and the production itself as an outstanding series. And also a previous guest on the podcast, Erin Cherry, was also one of the recipients of those Emmys, you know, for Best Supporting Actress. Now, why do you think that this show has resonated so much with viewers and critics alike?
Michael and I set out to write a story and create a story about two men who had everything in life until one day they didn't. And, you know, Michael had joked with me, and I thought the day that we were having this conversation, he was going to say, I can't do this. It's not working. he said, Kevin, I can't think of a way to make your character likable. I went, what? Because, I mean, you know, we got to give you some sort of reason why you need to be in a relationship. I mean, why are you out of one? Look at you. And I went, what? Look at me. Have you seen me eat? Come on. I mean, I made a joke. I was like, he said, no, we got to find something heroic for you. Otherwise, who cares? And then I said, well, what about you? Are you in a relationship? And he said, no, I lost my partner about 2 years, a 15-year partner for about 2 years prior to this rare cancer. And I said, I'm so sorry. What was it? And he explained, and I said, do you still talk to him? And he heard the question, and he kind of rolled his eyes around. He knew what I was asking. He said, I kind of do. And I said, if we could use this idea of your, you know, pull from this story that you experienced, something personal, and put it into the story, we could tell the story in three different levels of reality, flashbacks, and my character, Brian, conjuring up Jason's ghost, if you will, and talking to him and working through his healing and working through the loss. So it was in that moment, the piece wrote itself. And we had so much, we said, we'll do that in second or third season. I mean, that was, but the answer is we set out to write something that's not seen on the canvas of guys over 35. We wanted to write a love story. And we wanted to tell the honesty of what was going on. And I think had Michael not offered that up, or was like, no, I'm not going to put my deceased partner's death idea in there, it could have been something else. But that's the way it was. And it also taught Michael and I how to get to know each other and how to work with each other, because we weren't really super friends. We knew each other on a soap.
Yeah.
On the soap, they don't even let you hang with the writers. They keep the camps separate. And now COVID, they probably have you in different, you know,
different parts of the country, right? Yeah,
different parts of the universe. I have to say, it's really wild. But we became friends by the end of our collaboration, and it was lovely. It was very lovely. I think about him all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Because in a tragic example of art imitating life, your co-writer and producer also lost his battle with cancer late last year. How has this loss affected the show itself, but also you personally, since you work so closely with him?
And in 2018, we launched the series, and about, I get thinking in my time brain, a month, I get a call. Sit down. And I've been calling him because I knew the show was becoming a success already, and we self-distributed it, but I wanted to get ahead and do season two and three. Let's write them so we can like do them back to back. And he says, I need to talk to you. I said, oh, there you are. What's going on? And I thought I did something. What did I do? You have to talk to me? And he said, explain that the doctors had found this cancer. I'm like, okay. And I asked him, how do you want me to support you on this? Do you want me to ask you every day? Do you want to tell me when things are going south? Because I don't want to see or view you as diseased. I want to see you as a healthy, strong, and vibrant talent. And he said, I take that. I said, great. And once in a while, I would check in. But that's where our friendship really arced. And that was 3.5 years. He was so sick during the Emmys. He was so beginning to get sick again during the filming of season two. And then season three, we had COVID, so we couldn't do season three. And that's when I said, Allison Van Orr said, we should do something current. Just keep our name out there. And we didn't want to do a Zoom call like that. Everyone's doing a Zoom call. And I don't know if you've seen it, but Riley's Unforgettable School Project is a documentary style remote shoot of everyone. It's like I sent a camera to you, I sent a camera to me, I sent a camera to Lisa, Katie, and we all had this script that we had done our lines to the camera, to Riley, to answer his questions. And Michael like cranked it out. I said, let's do this, this, and this. And he said, yeah, what about this? And then he wrote the script. I was like, oh my God, I got to raise money and we got to do this. And we did. And we finished it. I mean, we sent people in five cities, two countries, 13 people. That's a lot of running around with cameras. And he was there on the Zoom calls while we were filming, and he gave us notes, but you could just see he was wearing out. And I think for all of us, I went back to New York to actually film my remote piece in the house that I do it in the series, because Laura wasn't going to be there, the owner, and I could see Michael. So I saran wrapped and hazmated, and I got back to New York, and I saw him, and the day that I saw him, this is before we started shooting, and this was when I knew he had decided that it was going to end, was I said, what can I do for you today, my friend? I'm so glad to be here and see you. And he said, can you get me my old life back? I can't continue living like this. So again, what words are you putting into your reality? What attitude, what feeling, and what vibration? He was done. And I called Allison and I said, we are going to now watch the countdown. And we did. We did. And as we got closer and closer to finishing the editing, oh, our editor lost his mom. Allison's mom was sick. So what he's taught me, Michael taught me that, again, there is an opportunity to make art and creativity from the darkest places and the worst things that can ever happen. And I think we miss him. I mean, I see a picture of us over here on the counter. So, and there's been some moments where, like on my birthday for the last 4 years, I was always in New York. We have birthday dinner for me. And it was, you know, COVID was the only reason I thought I was going to miss dinner with him. But I think he's riding through us. I think there are some things that he actually has given me on a more, you know, he visits me a lot, and I, gotcha. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. I would assume that season three, whenever it starts up in production, it will be a rather meaningful one, because it'll be the first season without him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's all about him on a weird level. Like, I think he kind of knew on a certain level. Because season two deals with the relationship, the new relationship with Brian, and then the relationship says, I can't be in a three-way with you and Jason. That's like, you know. So he still hasn't let go of Jason. And while Brian is making every attempt to go to therapy and forget Jason, Jason is still there. And it's called After Forever. So it's making peace with it, you know, and because three or four people die in 1 month, does that necessarily mean you get a free pass to like, okay, ease for a while? Stuff could happen the next month.
Yeah.
So we're at this age, at this time, we are absolutely in the need to be aware and to be as loving as we can. And I don't think you get to do that or remember that as you get older.
Thank you so much for joining me and Kevin for our discussion about his amazing career and the struggles and setbacks he's faced along the way. I certainly hope you got as much from our conversation as I did, and if so, then please share this episode with anyone who you think could benefit from Why I'll Never Make It. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Publicity provided by Imagine PR Group. Incidental music featured in this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. Why I'll Never Make It is a part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.